Fomi Kavitaoui and the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Our headlines: the Russian president orders the military to send peacekeepers in two regions in eastern Ukraine hours after he recognized them as independent republics. Ukraine says its borders remain unchangeable, regardless of any actions or statements by Russia, as the UN Security Council holds an emergency meeting on the crisis. And people stage a sit-in protest in the Gaza Strip to express support for thousands of Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails. Thank you for joining us. Big news on the Ukraine conflict. Russia recognizes the independence of two breakaway regions in eastern Ukraine, accusing the Western-backed government in Kiev of committing genocide there.
We see that Kiev's leadership constantly says it does not want to abide the Minsk set of measures to solve the conflict. They are not interested in a peaceful solution. How long can this tragedy go on? How long can one endure it? In this regard, I consider it necessary to make a long overdue decision to immediately recognize the independence and sovereignty of the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic.
In his speech, Putin demanded that Kiev immediately end military operations there or face responsibility for possible bloodshed. The announcement brought people to the streets in the breakaway regions for celebrations. In a decree issued shortly after the announcement, Putin told the country's defense ministry to deploy troops into the two regions under a peacekeeping operation. Moscow has yet provided no details or date for any deployment. Russia has already denied any plans to attack Ukraine or annex Donetsk and Luhansk. Meanwhile, Putin has accused the West of cheating Moscow and dishonoring their promise to stop NATO's eastward expansion.
Today, we can only take a look at the map to understand how Western countries hold their promise to prevent NATO expansion to the east. They simply fooled us. We had five stages of NATO expansion, one after another. It has impacted very negatively on the nature of international relations and led to the loss of mutual trust.
Putin said he has information that the question of Ukraine's NATO membership is already decided, and it is just a matter of time. Putin said Kiev's admission to the alliance would pose a major security threat to his country, as this will multiply the danger of a sudden strike against Russia. Putin said the U.S. and NATO have fully ignored Russia's security concerns and its request for equal dialogue. He said Russia has now every right to take measures to protect its security, sovereignty, and values. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has reacted to Russia's decision, calling it a violation of his country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Russia's parliament is due to vote on Putin's recognition of the two regions on Tuesday. Russia's recognition of the two breakaway self-declared Donbass republics has sparked a tide of reactions worldwide, with unsurprisingly critical remarks and sanctions coming from the West. U.S. President Joe Biden has signed an executive order to prohibit trade and investment with the Luhansk and Donetsk territories in eastern Ukraine. The U.K. is following suit, saying it will announce significant and immediate new sanctions on Tuesday. The European Union described Russia's move as a blatant violation of international law, the territorial integrity of Ukraine, and the Minsk agreements. The bloc also vowed a unified and firm response, saying it will target those involved with sanctions. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says the recognition is an ill omen and a dark sign that things are moving in the wrong direction.
It is becoming clear that we're going to need to start applying as much pressure as we possibly can, because it is hard to see how this situation improves.
NATO Chief Jens Stoltenberg also condemned Russia's decision, accusing Moscow of seeking to stage a pretext to invade Ukraine once again. NATO members Poland and Latvia slammed what they described as the act of aggression against Ukraine and called for immediate sanctions. Canada and Australia have also pledged to respond with sanctions. Meanwhile, the UN chief scrapped his visit to Africa, citing the, quote, deteriorating situation regarding Ukraine. He says Russia's move is in violation of the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine and is inconsistent with the principles of the Charter of the United Nations. The UN Security Council has held an emergency meeting on Ukraine. In an address to the session, the United States branded Russia's recognition of the two breakaway regions of Donetsk and Luhansk as a pretext of war.
Russia's clear attack on Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity is unprovoked. It is an attack on Ukraine's status as a UN member state. It violates a basic principle of international law, and it defies our charter. What is more, this move by President Putin is clearly the basis for Russia's attempt to create a pretext for a further invasion of Ukraine.
Linda Thomas Greenfield called Russia's peacekeeping operation in eastern Ukraine nonsense. She said the consequences of Russia's actions will be dire across Ukraine, Europe, and the globe. Ukraine's ambassador to the UN also addressed the meeting. Sergei Kislytsia said his country's borders remain unchangeable regardless of any actions or statements by the Russian Federation. Russia, however, came out critical of the West's approach toward Ukraine, saying Moscow will not allow a new bloodbath in the breakaway regions.
We remain open to diplomacy for a diplomatic solution. However, allowing a new bloodbath in Donbass is something we do not intend to do.
Nebenzia said eastern Ukraine had been on the brink of what he called a new Ukrainian military adventure. He also warned Western powers to think twice and not worsen the situation. Meanwhile, China called for restraint by all sides to avoid further escalation. China's ambassador to the UN urged a diplomatic solution to the crisis. In order to discuss that story further, I'm now joined by Tim Anderson. He is the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, joining us from Sydney. Tim, welcome. Thank you for being with us. Well, what do you make of Russia's move recognizing the two breakaway regions as independent republics?
Well, NATO raised the pressure on Russia, and this is the result they got. The idea of a Russian invasion of Ukraine was always absurd in the sense that Russia is the biggest country on earth. It needs no land or territory, as Nazi Germany did some generations back. But given that Ukraine has been a type of failed state for the last 8 years, with that coup in Kiev and neo-Nazis and Blackwater mercenaries joining in the attacks on those breakaway parts of eastern Ukraine, Russia felt that it had to protect that part of Ukraine. Now, you can say it's technically a breach of international law, but of course, NATO has been violating the sovereignty and territorial integrity of dozens of countries up to this date, including occupying half of West Asian countries and a number of Latin American interventions and African interventions and so on. So really, it has to be seen as a partisan play of politics and not something we can fully understand through simple universal international law.
And what's your reaction and your analysis of the reactions that are actually pouring in from the U.S., Albania, NATO allies? These are some very strong reactions to Russia's move.
Yes, they're strong and they're predictable and they're all from the one direction, effectively. Those states allied with NATO that have been involved in the interventions in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, Yemen, and so on, those states really don't have much of a moral platform to talk about Russia's behavior in this respect. It's certainly the failed state in Ukraine posed a threat to Russia for some years, and Russia has not wanted to go beyond its absorption of Crimea into the Luhansk and Donetsk republics. But recognizing those republics, it's something that it's doing effectively to create a security buffer with all of the aggression that's been coming from NATO through the Ukraine pretext.
Well, at the Security Council's emergency meeting, both the Russian envoy and the Ukrainian envoy, they both expressed that they will remain open to a diplomatic solution to a crisis, but is there a window of opportunity for a diplomatic solution?
There was, because the Minsk agreements of 7 years ago were talking about Ukraine respecting an autonomous process in those eastern parts of Ukraine, in the Donbas region, but they never delivered on it in 7 years, and that's what the Russian president specifically cited. Now, the debate in the Security Council, I suggest, is going to be very predictable. Not entirely clear what China's going to do, because, of course, the US has been threatening the sovereignty and territorial integrity of China by arming and occupying part of China, that is to say Taiwan. So in principle, it's not entirely clear which way China is going to jump, but China is a strategic ally of Russia, and Russia is clearly going to veto any possible Security Council move there. So it's only going to deepen the divisions that have come into place since the US began imposing these unilateral coercive measures on dozens of countries. Let's remember, almost half the world now is subject to these economic siege measures, and it doesn't make much sense for the US to say it's going to impose trade embargo on Donbas, because Donbas had no US trade or investment in any case. It was under a blockade for the last 8 years.
Tim, thank you so much for joining us. That was Tim Anderson, the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies from Sydney. The Russian foreign minister has strongly condemned Israeli attacks on the Syrian territory, warning that such raids risk a major escalation across the region. In a joint press conference with a Syrian counterpart in Moscow, Sergei Lavrov stressed the need to stop the Israeli aggression carried out in violation of UN resolutions. Lavrov also slammed the U.S. military presence in Syria, which he said blocks the government's access to resources and encourages separatist agendas. Syria's top diplomat also noted that the U.S. military presence in northwestern Syria has displaced nearly 400,000 people. Faisal Miqdad accused Washington of investing in terrorism to achieve its political goals. Miqdad also described Israeli attacks in Syria as part of an attempt to protect the regime's territories or terrorist allies. He noted that the raids are carried out every time the Syrian government makes headway against terrorist groups. Palestinians in Gaza have expressed their solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails. Daily and weekly events are being held in the coastal enclave to boost the morale of prisoners. Ashraf Shannon has more in this report.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip staged a sit-in to support Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails and detention centers. During the sit-in, people shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and demanded the release of all Palestinian prisoners. Palestinian prisoners are political prisoners, and they are regarded as heroes and freedom fighters by all Palestinians.
The suffering of Palestinian prisoners has increased in recent months, especially following the bold escape operation in September. Prisoners, including women and children, suffer every day inside Zionist jails. The Zionist crimes against the prisoners must stop.
The sit-in comes at a time when hundreds of Palestinian detainees have been denied proper medical treatment in Israeli jails. Over 200 Palestinian detainees have died in Israeli prisons since 1967. During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Palestinian Ministry of Health condemned Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian prisoners, especially those suffering from chronic medical conditions.
For Palestinian inmates, Israeli prisons serve as gateways towards their death because of medical negligence. Currently, there are 700 very sick Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli prisons without proper medical care. Those sick prisoners are dying slowly as the world watches in silence.
Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers where they are denied basic human rights. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas demanded international protection for Palestinian prisoners.
We call on the Red Cross and all international organizations to help Palestinian prisoners, especially those who are sick in Zionist jails. We demand international protection for Palestinian prisoners. They are suffering because of the racist Zionist practices.
People here are calling on the international community to come out of its silence and help Palestinian prisoners.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, there are thousands of Palestinian prisoners suffering in Israeli prisons under inhumane detention conditions. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Hezbollah says it has successfully flown a drone on a reconnaissance mission over Israeli-occupied territories. The resistance movement says the UAV returned untouched, despite Israel's repeated attempts to down it. The operation once again lays bare the inefficiency of the regime's much-publicized Iron Dome system.
Around a month ago, Israeli media reported that the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, has increased its drone activities in Israeli airspace. The drone operations were mainly for gathering intel. Last Friday, the Israeli military activated the Iron Dome and scrambled fighter jets, but failed to intercept a drone from Lebanon. As a result, air raid sirens were sounded in the north, and later it was announced that Israeli fighter jets were spotted flying low over Beirut. Hezbollah later released a statement saying the drone named Hassan entered Israeli airspace on a reconnaissance mission at a depth of 70 kilometers for around 40 minutes before returning untouched. This was the second incident in as many days and comes after Hezbollah's Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah said the group was making its own drones in Lebanon. Pointing to Israeli threats, the Hezbollah chief said the enemies only threaten others with war, but they know it will be very difficult and costly for them. He said Hezbollah is capable of upgrading the quality of its rockets to fend off Israeli threats. In fact, Hezbollah has been increasing its fleet of unmanned aerial vehicles, and now it is estimated to have some 2,000 UAVs. Based on Israeli media reports, Hezbollah is also in possession of over 100,000 rockets, and Israel's existing missile systems neither are capable of intercepting such a number of missiles and rockets, nor can protect Israeli settlers. The launch of the radio-controlled aircraft on Friday seems like a message from Hezbollah. Even if the Israeli military sometimes manages to shoot down Hezbollah's UAVs or drones, the resistance movement can keep sending them into Israel at will. If Israel believes it is free to violate Lebanese sovereignty with UAVs and fighter jets, Hezbollah will do the same south of the border.
It is interesting to see how fragile it's entire military industrial complex actually is, and the latest event has just showed it once again that even though the Israeli regime is investing so many efforts and its so-called defense, it remains very weak, and it is the Lebanese resistance that continues to show the Israeli regime its own weakness.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
in the limelight.
Former U.S. Army prosecutor Glenn Kirshner has predicted that former President Donald Trump will be indicted, asserting that his days are numbered. The article you're about to hear has been taken from Newsweek and has been written by journalist Jason Lemon. The piece is titled Trump's Days Are Numbered. Kirshner predicts ex-president to be indicted. Former U.S. Army prosecutor Glenn Kirshner has predicted that former U.S. President Donald Trump will be indicted, asserting that his days are numbered. Manhattan Supreme Court Judge Arthur Engoron ruled last Thursday, 17th of February, that Trump and two of his adult children, Donald Trump Jr. and Ivanka Trump, must comply with subpoenas and answer questions under oath as part of an investigation led by New York Attorney General Letitia James. Glenn Kirshner on Saturday uploaded a short video to Twitter, overviewing that decision and providing his analysis of the situation. Donald Trump will be indicted, Kirshner asserted. I'm not sure which jurisdiction will indict him first, but he will be indicted. The attorney urged his followers to hold on tight because there's more to come. Glenn Kirshner said that the investigative circle continues to tighten around Donald Trump, arguing that Trump's days are numbered. It's coming, he continued. It's not coming quickly enough, but justice is coming. Like Kirshner, a number of other legal experts have assessed that Donald Trump is running out of good options following Manhattan Supreme Court Judge Arthur Engoron's decision last week. If Trump takes the fifth, it can be used against him in the civil case being developed by the New York Attorney General, former federal prosecutor Renato Moriarty tweeted. If Trump doesn't take the fifth, the Manhattan District Attorney can use his words against him. He's between a rock and a hard place. Watch the three Trumpketeers try to wiggle out of this order. Lawrence Tribe, a professor of constitutional law at Harvard University, tweeted. Lawrence Tribe added, civil contempt would land them in jail, with cooperation being their only key to get out of those ugly orange prison suits, not the Trump idea of high fashion. As for Donald Trump, he slammed the judge's ruling in a statement on Thursday, 17th of February. The statement read, "The targeting of a president of the United States who got more votes while in office than any president in history, by far, and is a person that the radical left Democrats don't want to run again, represents an unconstitutional attack on our country. And the people will not allow this travesty of justice to happen," the former president said. The statement continued, "It is a continuation of the greatest witch hunt in history. And remember, I can't get a fair hearing in New York because of the hatred of me by judges and the judiciary. It's not possible." In addition to the New York investigation, Donald Trump may also face a Justice Department probe over his handling of classified national security information. The former president removed classified documents from the White House and took them to his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida when he left office last year. The records have since been returned to the National Archives and Records Administration, NARA, but legal experts and former federal law enforcement officials have suggested that Donald Trump could face charges. Department of Justice, this ball is in your court, former FBI Assistant Director Frank Figliozzi tweeted after the National Archives and Records Administration confirmed that classified national security documents had been taken by Donald Trump. The National Archives and Records Administration, NARA, confirmed in a Friday letter to the House Oversight Committee that some 15 boxes that Donald Trump returned last month after being requested to do so contained classified national security documents. The National Archives and Record Administration has identified items marked as classified national security information within the boxes, archivist David Ferrero wrote. Previously, the New York Times reported that classified documents were included with the records that Donald Trump was required to return. The Washington Post further reported that some of the documents were classified as top secret. Glenn Kirshner gave his assessment of the scandal during an MSNBC segment on Friday, 18th of February. Kirshner said, "That is a 5-year felony. If that were you or me, you can bet we'd already be indicted." Donald Trump also dismissed the classified documents scandal in a Friday statement. In his statement, Trump said, "The National Archives did not find anything. They were given, upon request, presidential records in an ordinary and routine process to ensure the preservation of my legacy and in accordance with the Presidential Records Act," the former president said. He argued if the scandal involved anyone else, there would be no story here. Newsweek has reached out to Donald Trump's press office for comment, but has not heard back in time for publication.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello and and welcome to the latest installment of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. I'm your host, Robert Carter. This week, we'll examine the ethnic cleansing of Sheikh Jarrah in the illegally occupied Al-Quds, with a special focus on the British and American groups channeling huge sums of money to the settlers in the Palestinian capital. As always, we'll be joined by expert guests to delve into the background of Israel's ethnic cleansing and explore what can be done to stop it. But first, Bianca Rahimi gets us started with this special report.
The world saw the hypocrisy of Zionism, shorn of its pretensions, when the besieged Palestinian residents of Sheikh Jarrah turned their cameras on New Yorker settler Jacob Fushi as he uttered these infamous words.
You are stealing my house!
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going to steal it.
Today, Sheikh Jarrah still stands in the crosshairs of Zionist settler mass theft, with the Al-Salahiyah family sadistically removed in the dead of night and their house bulldozed to the ground. Sheikh Jarrah is a microcosm for the rest of Palestine, and the ethnic cleansing of the indigenous population continues. However, Sheikh Jarrah is closer to us than we think. Those who fund the continuous Nakba there are among us. From Roman Abramovich, billionaire owner of Chelsea Football Club, and Jan Koum, founder of WhatsApp and former board member of Facebook, both funding settler group David, to media mogul Rupert Murdoch, funding the Jerusalem Foundation, which builds for settlers in Sheikh Jarrah. There are some well-known figures involved in these crimes against the Palestinians. But you may be surprised to know that the most prominent Islamophobic figures in both the UK and the US are funded by the same people that fund the settlers in Sheikh Jarrah. The Klarman Family Foundation, based in Boston, USA, has pumped millions into the David settler group cleansing Sheikh Jarrah. In addition to that, it has funded the Center for Security Policy, which gave us former US President Donald Trump's Muslim ban. The foundation has also pumped money into the Middle East Forum, which funded Tommy Robinson, who describes Muslims in the UK as enemy combatants. Another is the New York-based Herzog Foundation, led by Roger Herzog. His foundation has financed not only the David settlers of Sheikh Jarrah, but also the Henry Jackson Society, relentless pusher of Islamophobic policy against Muslims in the UK, the Center for Security Policy, and the David Horowitz Center, which has employed Tommy Robinson, Katie Hopkins, and Ben Shapiro. The New Jersey-based Russell Berry Foundation, led by former managing director at BlackRock and David Rosenblatt, has funded David alongside a U.S. group named the Investigative Project of Terrorism. This group was found to be infiltrating and spying on Muslim civil rights organization CARE in the U.S. The founder of the organization, Steve Emerson, is responsible for creating the myth of there being Muslim-only zones in the UK. The US-based Abstraction Fund also pumps money into David. It's run by Nina Rosenwald, the heir to the Vicks VapoRub fortune. She is best known for directing massive sums to Islamophobic groups. These include the Henry Jackson Society in the UK and the Middle East Forum. So, the same money being pumped into Sheikh Jarrah to dispossess the Palestinians there is also being pumped into a city near you to demonize, surveil, legislate against, and even attack Muslims on the streets. We can now reveal that there is a local branch of the main settler group in Sheikh Jarrah based in London by the name of UK Friends of the City of David. The directors of this UK-based operation are the very same figures from its US and Al-Quds-based counterparts. Rabbi Yehuda Mali founded and is the co-president of the Al-Quds-based settler organization. He is a director of the UK branch and also a board member of the US branch. He is also employed by the Israeli Ministry of Education as a strategic advisor. He founded the Hasbin settlement in the illegally occupied Golan Heights of Syria. Another founder of the settler group, also on the UK board, is David Be'iri. He served as deputy commander of the Duvdevan elite Israeli military unit, known for clandestine operations in the West Bank, in which they disguised themselves as Palestinians. In October 2010, he was caught on video deliberately ramming two Palestinian miners with his car and driving away. 7 years later, the Israeli regime controversially awarded him the Israel Prize for Lifetime Achievement. An additional director of the organization is Doran Spielman. He is a vice president of the Israeli settler group and currently works as spokesman for the Israeli military. The only London-based director of the UK charity is Daniel Peters, a partner with the global investment practice at Aon Hewitt. He seems to be the only one permanently based in the UK. Perhaps we should pay him a visit. The Ir David UK branch has received funding from the Erinder Rothschild Foundation, which has also been a key donor to the Sheikh Jarrah Settlement Building Jerusalem Foundation, as well as to organizations known to be Islamophobic, like the Henry Jackson Society and the disgraced and now defunct Quilliam Foundation. Joyce Anley, a Conservative Foreign Office minister, described this organization as carrying out radical settler activities under the guise of tourism. She questioned Israel's closeness to such a group, but now the question must be why the UK Charity Commission allows a group with a stated objective of demographic change in an occupied territory to operate on UK soil. The fact remains that those who fund the existential war against the Palestinians of Sheikh Jarrah are also funding a war against Muslims worldwide.
To discuss the ethnic cleansing of Sheikh Jarrah and the forces behind it, we're joined today by two expert guests. Asa Wynne-Stanley is an investigative journalist who writes for the award-winning Palestinian news website, The Electronic Intifada, and also has a weekly column for the Middle East Monitor. He's joined by our esteemed program expert, David Miller, who is an academic and former professor at Bristol University and co-founder of the lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. And now I'm going to go straight to you, David, and get your expert opinion on this, because I know that you've researched extensively into the UK Friends of the City of David and its US equivalent. Perhaps you could just tell us how true is it and how much of money from the West is going into supporting ethnic cleansing in occupied Palestine. And also perhaps you could update us on any other groups that may be active in the UK doing similar type of work.
Well, in relation to the Friends of David, I mean, there are literally millions of dollars going in to Sheikh Jarrah and in other places from this organization, especially from the US Foundation. I mean, you saw some of the people involved there in the film. One of them, the guy from WhatsApp, gave $3 million to the foundation. Now, in the UK, they haven't managed so far to raise so much money. It's in the scores of thousands so far. But they have had some significant donors. They ran the Rothschild Foundation. It's the Rothschild family main a charitable foundation in this country, and they have put money into, effectively, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And as we saw in the film, they also give money to other organizations. It was mentioned a couple of times there, the Jerusalem Foundation, an organization which is dedicated to Judaizing East Jerusalem and to forcing Palestinians out. There are many other organizations in my research. I haven't got time to list them all because there are literally hundreds of other organizations who are raising money for specific settlements to fund the IDF and its brutal tactics in the West Bank and Gaza. These are all organizations, by and large, which have a charitable status in the UK. So that this is a very wide-scale problem, but it's not really been dealt with in public debate so far.
That is interesting, especially given the fact, Asa, that, you know, depending on where someone wanted to put their money in support of, let's say, the Palestinians, you could get in a lot of trouble there. That's probably a topic for another episode. But I want to ask you about the earlier on in that report by Bianca, the gentleman from New York who suddenly showed up in a home which used to belong to a Palestinian family. They confronted him and so on. I'm sure you remember it went absolutely viral at the time. Perhaps you could just remind us about how this type of thing is happening. A guy from New York, an American citizen, ending up in a Palestinian person's home. Is he even spending any money himself? Or is it something which is being funded externally, that type of thing?
Yeah, he's probably not really spending much money himself. The Israeli settlers all over the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, are funded and subsidized extensively by the State of Israel and by these foreign foundations, charity. You know, these groups often have charitable status, really, in our countries, in the UK and the US and all over the Western world, really. I think it's important to remember that's been happening in Sheikh Jarrah and other neighborhoods of East Jerusalem is really common all over the West Bank. This is exactly what is happening day in and day out to the Palestinians. Palestinians are being driven off their land. They're being driven from their homes and then replaced with European, mostly European Jewish settlers who have come to take over their homes, be guided by this ideological vision, this racist settler colonial vision. And, you know, it's implemented. We're seeing it. These are just common everyday scenes from Palestine. People's homes are being demolished on the pretext of not having permits. And I say a pretext because almost invariably those permits are never given to Palestinians precisely and solely because they are not Jewish, because Israel defines itself as a Jewish state. It's a state only for Jews with a tolerated minority of so-called Arab Israelis, even though most Palestinians within the state of Israel identify themselves as Palestinians. So, yeah, this is not an abstract thing of, oh, settlements are bad. This is people's daily lives. People have been driven out of their homes because their only crime, quote-unquote, is that they're not Jewish.
And that is obviously a shocking fact,
yeah.
that we're dealing with here.
Yeah, but, and money from this country and money from America, money from France, money from all over the Western world especially, is going into these organisations and being subsidised effectively by British taxpayers, because these organisations, these extreme Zionist settler organisations, have charitable status quite often in the UK and the US.
That brings me on to my next question, actually, because, again, Bianca's report exposed the fact that a lot of money goes into Islamophobic groups as well. So there seems to be this partnership, if you like, between Zionist organizations, which are trying to push the settler expansion program in occupied Palestine, but then there are all these groups that are being funded as well, which basically go after the religion of Islam and Muslims as well, and so on. So perhaps, again, you could just tell us what you know about this money going into groups like maybe the Henry Jackson Society, for example, that are known for going after Muslims and Muslim beliefs.
Well, David's research, really, David has done more than anyone, really, I think, to expose this kind of tight connection between the Zionist movement, between the Israel lobby on one hand, and between what's been termed the Islamophobia industry or the counter-jihad movement. And David has done extensive academic work on this over the years, that's really important to look at. There is this real merging of interests, because the far right in Europe, in Western Europe, has for many years, and especially since 9/11, made Muslims, the Muslim population of Europe, their number one enemy. They made the Muslims the scapegoat in a very similar way to Jews in Nazi Germany and in Eastern Europe prior to the Holocaust were made the scapegoat of European racism, of European far-right racism, and even, not necessarily extremists, but the actual states. The British state before Hitler was extremely anti-Semitic, and so in a similar way now, the British state has these very close ties to the Islamophobic industry and is also making Muslims the scapegoat. So it doesn't necessarily take these extremist groups, but the extremist groups are working hand in hand with the state of Israel and the Zionist movement. And we saw, in the VT, Tommy Robinson, one of the most notorious anti-Muslim extremists he's done these high profile visits to occupied territory along with Israeli soldiers. There was a very famous photo that he tweeted out of him standing with an Israeli rifle on an Israeli tank in the occupied Golan Heights of Syria.
Yes, I remember.
So these connections are ongoing and intimate.
We will come back to you, David, to go into a bit more depth into the nitty-gritty of these stories that we're covering. But we have a very interesting report to bring on next, which takes us over to Latifa Abu Shakra. She tried to pay a visit to the London-based director of the UK Friends of the City of David, Daniel Peters. Latifa wanted to see how he would justify his involvement in ethnic cleansing.
David are instrumental in the cleansing of Palestinians from Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. Yet most people in the UK have no idea that a branch exists here.
Despite the funding thrust into David, their directors have received generally very little scrutiny. We decided to pay a visit to the London home of the only UK-based director of the organisation. On a sunny winter's day, we tried to talk to Daniel Peters. So despite the cleaner informing us that the family were home, they did not open the door, despite several attempts. It's clear to see that they had cameras placed around the premises, so security is an issue for them. What are they trying to hide?
Well, there you have it. So Latifa doing her absolute best to confront people involved in this practice. David, I'm going to come to you on this. What did you make of that? And perhaps you could just elaborate a little bit more on if there are any other directors, any other key figures which should be known to the audience.
Well, most of the directors in the UK branch are based in Al-Quds, in Palestine. This is the only one who's based in the sense of living in the UK. There is one other director who has a registered address here, but it appears also to live in 48 Palestine. So this is an organisation essentially run from abroad, but with one director here who's an actuary who has been involved from very early on in this organisation, and has a very low profile. Now, it's interesting, isn't it? There's an organisation here spending lots of money, raising funds to engage in activities which are, on the face of it, in breach of international law. The wider question here is the extent to which this should be allowed to continue. I mean, this is a guy whose house is not under threat. He's been visited by a journalist. He's not been asked to leave his house, to give his house to a Palestinian, which in some ways would be a fair thing to do, given that he is personally involved in depriving particular Palestinian families of their homes as we speak. But there is no public debate about this, and perhaps there should be. And I suppose this is one of the things which is interesting about this whole issue, is that this goes on under the radar, with nobody really seeing or paying attention to it. And perhaps that's something which is about to change.
I think it is interesting to note that in past episodes, again, we've tried to gain contact with organisations which push a kind of Israeli line in the UK education system. And again, they're just hard to get in touch with, these organisations, these individuals that do this type of work. They just don't seem to have numbers, don't seem to be at their offices, don't seem to answer the door, as was this case. Asa, I'm going to bring you back in. Perhaps you could put forward the case for the boycott of these organisations, why it's so important that we do push this initiative, and again, why it's important to for us to highlight what they're up to, identify who's responsible, and then, of course, that's when the boycott action can come into play.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, that none of these organisations, Israel lobby organisations, who are directly involved in ethnic cleansing in East Jerusalem, for example, seem to want to show their faces at all, because they like to do things behind closed doors. I mean, I find it fascinating because ostensibly they have all the support they could possibly ever get. You know, the British government endorses this stuff, despite, you know, public-facing statements from British ministers about, oh, we're deeply concerned about settlements and things and the human rights situation in the West Bank. They say these sort of meaningless statements. Despite those kind of statements, in actual fact, the British government is deeply involved and deeply complicit in this kind of ethnic cleansing. And, it allows not only these kind of organisations to carry out their fundraising activities in this country, but also they support Israel at the highest level, at diplomatic level, at the level of allowing arms exports to Israel, and of the tax-deductible donations to these charities, the tax-exempt status these organisations often have. It does make the BDS movement important, because the BDS movement is a way that people on the popular level can put pressure on Israel and can... our government is not going to act. You know, thoughts and concerns are going to do nothing. They're just a way to distract attention from the British government's involvement in these crimes. So BDS puts Israel on the defensive, and it leads to it means there's a wider popular pressure against Israel to, you know, there's a cost for Israel to, if it continues these crimes, that we can put pressure on Israel. And this is why, you know, the British government has been, for several years now, has been, you know, threatening to outlaw BDS, quote unquote. Well, you know, they keep saying they're going to do that, but then they don't actually do it. Because in practice, how can you outlaw BDS? You can't really. You can't stop someone.
It's like thought policing, isn't it?
Yeah, and you can't stop someone not buying something. You know, it's not. It's kind of a logical impossibility. So, but you know, public, there is measures they can take. You know, to chill and kind of repress public campaigning. But you know, I think ultimately those kind of measures are not going to be successful. And BDS has really gone from strength to strength in that regard. So, yeah,
for sure. Now, David, I want to come back to you because possibly one of the most important questions of this show is related to the fact that we heard earlier on in the episode Joyce Annaley, Conservative Foreign Office Minister, describe the organisation, referring back to Bianca's report, as carrying out radical settler activities under the guise of tourism. So perhaps you could go into what you think of that. And the fact is that it's now surely a question for the UK Charity Commission, isn't it? I mean, are these guys breaking the law?
Well, I mean, this is an interesting thing, isn't it? Because to be a charity, you have to show public benefit. And even a Conservative Foreign Office Minister is saying, it looks like there's not a public benefit here, that actually this is a disguise. This is not about archaeological digs and lovely parts of ancient Al-Quds or Jerusalem. This is about explorations and demolitions to make way for Jewish settlers. And it's, if even Conservative ministers believe this is to be the case, then it's quite clear there's a disconnect between what the activities are and what they have said they are to give themselves charitable status. So, they, you know, the next question, of course, is, well, what is the Charity Commission doing about this? And I would urge people who are able to do so to write to the Charity Commission to raise those questions, to say, you know, this is an organisation which is clearly engaging in activity which is illegal under international law, and it should not be given charitable status. And that, hopefully, is the thing which can start to open up the space for a whole series of other organisations, including very mainstream Zionist organisations like, for example, the Jewish National Fund, which is engaged in ethnic cleansing and settlement in the occupied territories in the same way as the City of David people are, but has much more money, has millions of pounds every year going into effectively illegal operations. So I think that this is really the next front for BDS, is to close down all these charities. You know, we start with one and then we close them all. And that's really what we have to do in order to defeat Zionism. We have to defeat the means by which it sustains itself, which includes the money which comes from this country.
And I know that that is a front which is already being used by pro-Israel groups. They are going after Muslim charities, yeah, and things like that, trying to brand them as extremists for what? Putting money into Gaza to try and help civilians there and things like that. We are approaching the end of the show, gentlemen, so unfortunately I'll have to stop it there, but I'm sure we'll have you both back on very, very soon in the near future, especially you, David. But that is unfortunately all the time we have for this edition of the show, but thank you for tuning in, and don't worry, we'll be back next time for more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. It's goodbye for now.
The Limelight.
A New York judge has ruled that former U.S. President Donald Trump will have to testify in his Ford investigation, leaving him sweating and his investors shaking their heads. We're prepared for you an article written by Lloyd Green, an attorney in New York who was opposition research counsel to George H.W. Bush's 1988 campaign, and served in the Department of Justice from 1990 to 1992. The piece is titled, It's Trump's Time to Tell the Truth, the Whole Truth and Nothing But the Truth. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's bad luck continues. On Thursday afternoon, 17th of February, Arthur Engoron, a Manhattan judge, gave the thumbs up to subpoenas issued to Trump, favorite child Ivanka, and Donald Trump Jr. by Letitia James, New York's Attorney General. The court's ruling follows a decision by Trump's accountants to walk away from the one-term president and disavow years of financial statements issued by his company. Much as the Trump trio tried, they could not shut down Letitia James's investigation into the Trump Organization's business practices, which could lead to a civil lawsuit by Letitia James. Unlike a criminal prosecution, a civil action comes with a lower burden of proof for the government. At the same time, civil lawsuits can drag on, like right into 2024. Barring a stay, Donald Trump and his two children have been ordered to appear at deposition within 21 days. If they tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, who knows what liability may result? On the other hand, if they invoke their right to remain silent, they will probably be portrayed as criminals. Donald Trump observed on the campaign trail in 2016, he said, "You see, the mob takes the Fifth," adding, "If you're innocent, why are you taking the Fifth Amendment?" But time surely flies, and if the Trump family refuses to appear at deposition or simply stays mum when grilled, they risk being charged with contempt, a distinction presently held by Steve Bannon, Donald Trump's White House counselor and 2016 campaign guru. At this moment in time, Donald Trump must be sweating while his lenders have to be shaking their collective heads. How much is Trump worth and how bad can things get are no longer hypothetical issues. In the absence of operative financial statements,